Now, time for us to catch up on stories making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, a crackdown on the LGBTQ community in Beirut and an unidentified floating object in Japan. But first we go to Iraq, and it's been 20 years since George W. Bush announced the launch of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Far from freeing the people, the US-led invasion led to a vicious sectarian civil war, the emergence of Islamic State, and a general collapse of infrastructure. It also enabled Iran to gain influence in the country through its powerful proxies. But as Lorraine Malander reports, Iraqis are tired of foreign influence and now want to take their country back.
20 years ago, the world watched as a statue of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was pulled down on Baghdad's Firdaus Square to the jubilant cheers of what seemed to be a massive crowd of locals. As it turned out, the spectacle had been jollied along by the US Marines, and the crowd was far smaller than the tightly framed images played on loop by the world's media suggested. These images told a tale of victory that proved to be misleading. America had invaded Iraq with very little understanding of the country's internal dynamics. Soon, the liberators became unwelcome occupiers. Fast forward to 2023, and a new story is being told on Firdaus Square. Not far from the spot where Saddam's statue once stood, there's a giant billboard depicting the Oval Office, the iconic workspace of successive US presidents, bathed in blood. Bobbing amidst the sinking objects is a Statue of Liberty, a Hollywood sign, and a bust of former US President Donald Trump, his bouffant hairdo instantly recognisable. The architects of this gory propaganda are Iraq's Shia militias, which have strong links to Iran. Some go back to the times when Saddam Hussein oppressed the Shia, sending many fleeing over the border to Iran. Others emerge later. These militias want Trump to pay for his assassination of two men they regard as heroes for leading the fight against Islamic State. It's been 3 years since the drone attack at Baghdad airport that killed top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and local militia leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The militias fought Islamic State under the direct command of these two men in a pragmatic, though uneasy, collaboration with US and Kurdish forces. Nowadays, their number one priority is booting US troops out of the country. Hence the billboard on Firdaus Square, telling a story of revenge, red in tooth and claw. The militias, whose leaders and backers currently dominate Iraq's parliament, hold great sway here and have been instrumental in helping Iran deepen its influence. Critics say that sanctions-bound Iran floods the country with its products, everything from milk to machinery, exchanged for much-needed US dollars. The US Army was not wrong when it admitted in a 2019 study that its $2 trillion war on terror produced one victor, an emboldened and expansionist Iran. But like the US before it, Iran may now be outstaying its welcome. On Firdaus Square, ordinary Iraqis seem unmoved by the bloody billboard. They're sick of conflict, sick of corruption, sick of living in a state that made over $100 billion in oil revenues last year, yet still can't get it together to fix the collapsing electricity grid. Even Abbas, 36, who hails from an ultra-conservative Shia family, is not convinced. He's grateful for the militia's role in vanquishing Islamic State, but, he says, Iran creates problems with America and other countries. We want to have a peaceful life with good electricity, good health and good education in Iraq, he says. 3 years ago, young Iraqis of all creeds, Shia, Sunni, Christian, took to the streets to overturn the corrupt system. Iran bara bara, they shouted. Iran out. The Tishrin uprising, named after the month of October 2019 when it began, emerged from the ground up, driven by social media with no political leaders. The new generation wanted to take charge of its destiny. Veteran activist Hashim Tomi, 34 years old, had taken part in successive waves of protest over the past decade, but Tishrin was different, he says. The new generation, too young to remember the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, are more fearless. They're all opening up to the world. They compare their lives to other countries and they don't want to see religion mixed up in politics anymore, he says. He believes people will return to the streets. The revolution is not over, he says. It will happen again and again and again. For World Report, this is Lorraine Malander.
Next, we go to Beirut in Lebanon, a place where the LGBTQ community has for years been among the most visible in the Middle East. But a crackdown by authorities in Beirut, targeting people for money and conducting surveillance on them, has threatened the security of the community, as Hannah McCarthy reports.
In a sea of 35,000 singing fans in Cairo, Sarah Hegazi climbs onto the shoulders of a friend and raises a rainbow flag. In front of her, Mushru Leila, a Lebanese rock band known for their Arabic lyrics about love, revolution and queerness, are performing. It's 2017 and Hamid Sino, the openly gay frontman of the band, is singing the words to Kalam. If your touch was as sweet as your dance, come a little closer. There's hell under my skin and your hands are cold. For the rest of the night, everyone felt safe and seen and loved, says Hamid. It felt like the queers had won the Arab Spring. After their performance in Cairo, Mushru Leila boarded a flight to New York. By the time they arrived, they found out they'd been banned from Egypt. Over the next week, 75 attendees from the band's concert were detained by Egyptian security forces on the grounds of public indecency. Sarah Hegazi was detained for 3 months. While in prison, she was assaulted, electrocuted, and mentally tortured. After her release, she was granted asylum in Canada, but found herself isolated and struggling to cope with the aftermath of her torture. In 2020, midway through June, when Pride is typically celebrated, she tragically died by suicide. Hamid Sino described Sarah as everything our societies are built to silence. A queer woman, a feminist, an activist, and a communist who had renounced her hijab. She spoke out, and for speaking out, she was cruelly punished. Hamid is well aware of the risks that LGBTQ people pay for speaking up. Even in Lebanon, one of the most liberal countries in the Arab world, Mushru Leila have received death threats and been banned from performing at festivals due to pressure from religious leaders and state authorities. After fleeing conservative villages and repressive regimes in other Arab countries, Beirut is often the first place where many queer people can find spaces to express themselves openly. But only tiny pockets of Lebanon are truly safe. Sasha Elijah, a Lebanese trans model, says there's no point in queer people being visible in Lebanon if they have no protection. It's a trap, she says. Last June in Ashrafia, in central Beirut, a Christian group which called itself the Soldiers of God posted a video of its members tearing apart a rainbow that was formed with flowers for Pride Month. Following this, the Lebanese Interior Minister then banned gatherings that promoted what he called the phenomenon of sexual deviance and described such activities as a violation of the habits and traditions of our society. The decision, which was intended to ban Pride events, was eventually reversed, but added to the growing sense of anxiety for the LGBT community in Beirut. Many have seen an uptick in social media apps being used to blackmail and extort money from queer people, particularly Syrian refugees, who are especially vulnerable because they lack formal residency in Lebanon. It feels very intimidating and quite scary to be a queer person in Lebanon right now, says Tariq Zidane, head of the LGBTQ NGO Helem, named after the Arabic term for dream. Several people who reported being extorted to the Lebanese authorities ended up getting arrested themselves. Police officers often demand access to people's phones and routinely take copies of photos and messages from apps like Grindr, which the LGBTQ community often use to connect with each other. The Lebanese economic crisis has also had a more pronounced effect on already vulnerable groups. Today, many queer people are unemployed and lack access to proper housing and healthcare. Aid agencies and the government usually prioritise traditional families for humanitarian support and often rely on faith-based organisations to deliver programmes. This means queer couples and individuals are often left behind and don't feel comfortable approaching food kitchens run by churches or mosques. At the end of last year, Mushru Leila officially announced that they would no longer perform as a band. The constant pressure of physical threats and the bans on performing across the Middle East had finally taken their toll and scattered the band across different countries. We want our queer stories to have a happy ending, says Haig Papazian, one of the members of Mushru Leila, who now lives in New York. but the reality is often much harsher. Instead, we're isolated and far from home. And from our new safe houses, we watch our worlds and dreams burn to the ground. For World Report in Beirut, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Finally, we go to Japan, where the discovery of a strange round object washed ashore on a beach led to intense speculation as to its origin and purpose. From Japan, Brian Gaynor reports.
Twitter, typically, had the best suggestions. A giant takoyaki, a Dragon Ball, Godzilla's egg, and my own particular favourite, a baby Death Star. The unidentified floating object, or UFO, that washed up on the shore of Hamamatsu, a city some 250 kilometres south of Tokyo, has provoked intense speculation about its origins and purpose. A spherical, rust-pocked metal object, approximately 1.5 metres in diameter, was discovered on a sandy beach by a woman out walking her dog. Fearing it was a mine, she called the police. They cordoned off the area and sent their bomb squad lumbering across the sand to investigate. From x-rays taken on site, the police quickly determined that it wasn't a mine and that the sphere contained nothing more than air. Although it would be easy to dismiss the whole incident as a typical Japanese overreaction to a seemingly benign object, the country has a right to be concerned. A couple of days prior to the object being discovered, North Korea tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that plunged into the Sea of Japan a mere 200 kilometers west of Hokkaido. Earlier in February, there was the intense diplomatic furor over the high-altitude Chinese balloon that had floated, and presumably photoed, its way across the United States. The Japanese government belatedly acknowledged that similar balloons had been observed over Japan in recent years. These constant provocations of Japanese security and sovereignty form a kind of geopolitical background hum to life here that may be difficult for Irish people to understand. Ireland has the geographical good fortune to be situated next to relatively amicable neighbours who, rugby matches aside, don't wish to do us any harm. By contrast, Japan finds itself adjacent to countries who are a lot more hostile. The continuous shrill belligerence of North Korea and its constant saber-rattling is well known. More concerning for Japan, though, is the increasing military cooperation between China, its most powerful neighbour, and Russia, its closest neighbour. Last November saw Chinese and Russian strategic bombers fly an unprecedented series of joint sorties over the Sea of Japan. Likewise, both countries' navies regularly sail through Japanese maritime territory in overt displays of military might. All this represents an increasingly perilous disruption of the de facto status quo that had endured for so long in the region. In 2013, the then Japanese government described China as a strategic partner in building a prosperous and safe East Asia. An indication of just how far and how quickly this partnership has deteriorated came last December when the current Japanese government described China as the greatest strategic challenge ever to securing the peace and stability of Japan. In tandem, the government also announced that it was going to double military spending in the next 5 years to $314 billion. It will, for the first time in the post-war period, authorize the Japanese military to acquire long-range missiles capable of attacking military installations in foreign countries. Perhaps the most surprising aspect of all this is that it seems to be accepted, albeit reluctantly, by the Japanese people. For much of its post-World War II history, the bedrock of Japanese political identity has been its anti-war constitution and voters' ingrained sense of conservative pacifism. However, the constant provocations by North Korea and Russia's invasion of Ukraine have distinctly changed the national mood. Public opinion polls now show a majority in favour of Japan taking a more proactive role in its security and defense. Back in Hamamatsu, the UFO has been removed from the beach. It seems to have been a large buoy, usually used for mooring oil tankers. On Twitter, initial apprehension has turned to embarrassment. Why couldn't we recognize a simple buoy? It's so embarrassing for us Japanese, was a typical post. However, a temporary loss of face won't alleviate Japanese people's underlying concern that the next object may not be so benign. For World Report, this is Brian Gaynor in Japan.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.